Tea Time's face was young and open and friendly. Or at least, it smiled all the time. But the effect was spoiled for most people by the fact that it had only one eye. Some unexplained accident had taken the other one, and the missing orb had been replaced by a ball of glass. The result was disconcerting. But what bothered Lord Downey far more was the man's other eye, the one that might loosely be called normal. He'd never seen such a small and sharp pupil. Tea Time looked at the world through a pinhole. He found he'd retreated behind his desk again. There was that about Tea Time, you always felt happier if you had something between you and him.
"You like animals, do you?" he said. "I have a report here that says you nailed Sir George's dog to the ceiling."
"Couldn't have it barking while I was working, sir." "Some people would have drugged it." "Oh." Tea Time looked despondent for a moment, but then he brightened. "But I definitely fulfilled the contract, sir. There can be no doubt about that, sir. I checked Sir George's breathing with a mirror as instructed. It's in my report." "Yes, indeed." Apparently the man's head had been several feet from his body at that point. It was a terrible thought that Tea Time might see nothing incongruous about this.
"And the servants," he said.
"Couldn't have them bursting in, sir." Downey nodded, half hypnotized by the glassy stare and the pinhole eyeball.
"No, you couldn't have them bursting in. And an assassin might well face serious professional opposition, possibly even by people trained by the same teachers. But an old man and a maidservant who'd merely had the misfortune to be in the house at the time... There was no actual rule, Downey had to admit. It was just that over the years the guild had developed a certain ethos, and members tended to be very neat about their work, even shutting doors behind them and generally tidying up as they went. Hurting the harmless was worse than a transgression against the moral fabric of society. It was a breach of good manners. It was worse even than that. It was bad taste. But there was no actual rule.
"That was all right, wasn't it, sir?" said Tea Time, with apparent anxiety.
It lacked elegance," said Downey.
"Ah, thank you, sir. I'm always happy to be corrected. I shall remember that next time." Downey took a deep breath.
"It's about that I wish to talk," he said. He held up the picture of, what had the thing called him, the fat man. "As a matter of interest," he said, "how would you go about inhuming this gentleman?" Anyone else, he was sure, would have burst out laughing. They would have said things like, "Is this a joke, sir?"
Tea Time merely leaned forward with a curious, intent expression. "Difficult, sir."
"Certainly," Downey agreed.
"I would need some time to prepare a plan, sir," Tea Time went on.
"Of course, and..."
There was a knock at the door, and Carter came in with another cup and saucer. He nodded respectfully to Lord Downey and crept out again.
"Right, sir," said Tea Time.
"I'm sorry," said Downey, momentarily distracted.
"I have now thought of a plan, sir," said Tea Time patiently.
"You have?"
"Yes, sir."
"As quickly as that?"
"Yes, sir."
"Ye gods."
"Well, sir, you know we are encouraged to consider hypothetical problems."
"Oh, yes, yes, a very valuable exercise." Downey stopped and then looked shocked.
"You mean you have actually devoted time to considering how to inhume the Hogfather?" he said weakly. "You've actually sat down and thought out how to do it? You've actually devoted your spare time to the problem?"
"Oh, yes, sir. And the Soul Cake Duck, and the Sandman,
and Death."
Downey blinked again.
"You've actually sat down and considered how..."
"Yes, sir. I've amassed quite an interesting file. In my own time, of course."
"I want to be quite certain about this, Mr. Tea Time. You have applied yourself to a study of ways of killing death?"
"Only as a hobby, sir."
"Well, yes, hobbies, yes. I mean, I used to collect butterflies myself," said Downey, recalling those first moments of awakening pleasure at the use of poison and the pin.
"But actually, sir, the basic methodology is exactly the same as it would be for a human. Opportunity, geography, technique. You just have to work with the known facts about the individual concerned. Of course, with this one, such a lot is known."
"And you've worked it all out, have you?" said Downey, almost fascinated.
"Oh, a long time ago, sir."
"When, may I ask?"
"I think it was when I was lying in bed one Hogswatch night, sir."
"My gods," thought Downey, "and to think that I just used to listen for sleigh bells." "My word," he said aloud.
"I may have to check some details, sir. I'd appreciate access to some of the books in the dark library. But yes, I think I can see the basic shape."
"And yet this person, some people might say that he is technically immortal."
"Everyone has their weak points, sir."
"Even death?"
"Oh, yes. Absolutely. Very much so."
"Really?"
Downey drummed his fingers on the desk again. The boy couldn't possibly have a real plan, he told himself. He certainly had a skewed mind. Skewed? It was a positive helix. But the fat man wasn't just another target in some mansion somewhere. It was reasonable to assume that people had tried to trap him before. He felt happy about this. Tea time would fail, and possibly even fail fatally, if his plan was stupid enough. And maybe the guild would lose the gold, but maybe not.
"Very well," he said. "I don't need to know what your plan is."
"That's just as well, sir."
"What do you mean?"
"Because I don't propose to tell you, sir. You'd be obliged to disapprove of it."
"I'm amazed that you're so confident that it can work, tea time."
"I just think logically about the problem, sir," said the boy. He sounded reproachful.
"Logically," said Downey.
"I suppose I just see things differently from other people," said tea time.
It was a quiet day for Susan, although on the way to the park, Gawain trod on a crack in the pavement, on purpose. One of the many terrors conjured up by the previous governess's happy way with children had been the bears that waited around in the street to eat you if you stood on the cracks. Susan had taken to carrying the poker under her respectable coat. One wallop generally did the trick. They were amazed that anyone else saw them. "Gawain," she said, eyeing a nervous bear who had suddenly spotted her and was now trying to edge away nonchalantly.
"Yes?"
"You meant to tread on that crack so that I'd have to thump some poor creature whose only fault is wanting to tear you limb from limb."
"I was just skipping."
"Quite. Real children don't go hoppity-skip, unless they're on drugs." He grinned at her. "If I catch you being twee again, I will knot your arms behind your head," said Susan levelly. He nodded and went to push Twyla off the swings. Susan relaxed, satisfied. It was her personal discovery. Ridiculous threats didn't worry them at all, but they were obeyed, especially the ones in graphic detail. The previous governess had used various monsters and bogeymen as a form of discipline. There was always something waiting to eat or carry off bad boys and girls for crimes like stuttering or defiantly and aggravatingly persisting in writing with their left hand. There was always a scissor man waiting for a little girl who sucked her thumb, always a bogeyman in the cellar. Of such bricks is the innocence of childhood constructed. Susan's attempts at getting them to disbelieve in the things only caused the problems to get worse. Twyla had started to wet the bed. This may have been a crude form of defence against the terrible clawed creature that she was certain lived under it. Susan had found out about this one the first night, when the child had woken up crying because of a bogeyman in the closet. She'd sighed and gone to have a look. She'd been so angry that she'd pulled it out, hit it over the head with a nursery poker, dislocated its shoulder as a means of emphasis, and kicked it out the back door. The children refused to disbelieve in the monsters, because frankly they knew damn well the things were there. But she'd found that they could very firmly also believe in the poker. Now she sat down on a bench and read a book. She made a point of taking the children every day somewhere they could meet others of the same age. If they got the hang of the playground, she thought, adult life would hold no fears. Besides, it was nice to hear the voices of little children at play, provided you took care to be far enough away not to hear what they were actually saying. There were lessons later on. These were going a lot better now she'd got rid of the reading books about bouncy balls and dogs called Spot. She'd got Gawain onto the military campaigns of General Tacticus, which were suitably bloodthirsty, but more importantly, considered too difficult for a child. As a result, his vocabulary was doubling every week, and he could already use words like disemboweled in everyday conversation. After all, what was the point in teaching children to be children? They were naturally good at it. And she was, to her mild horror, naturally good with them. She wondered suspiciously if this was a family trait. And if, to judge by the way her hair so readily knotted itself into a prim bun, she was destined for jobs like this for the rest of her life. It was her parents' fault. They hadn't meant it to turn out like this. At least, she hoped charitably that they hadn't. They'd wanted to protect her, to keep her away from the worlds outside this one, from what people thought of as the occult, from, well, from her grandfather, to put it bluntly. This had, she felt, left her a little twisted up. Of course, to be fair, that was a parent's job. The world was so full of sharp bends that if they didn't put a few twists in you, you wouldn't stand a chance of fitting in. And they'd been conscientious and kind and given her a good home, and even an education. It had been a good education, too. But it had only been later that she'd realised that it had been an education in education. It meant that if ever anyone needed to calculate the volume of a cone, then they could confidently call on Susan Stowe Hellett. Anyone at a loss to recall the campaigns of General Tacticus or the square root of 27.4 would not find her wanting. If you needed someone who could talk about household items and things to buy in the shops in five languages, then Susan was at the head of the queue. Education had been easy. Learning things had been harder. Getting an education was a bit like a communicable sexual disease. It made you unsuitable for a lot of jobs, and then you had the urge to pass it on. She'd become a governess. It was one of the few jobs a known lady could do. And she'd taken to it well. She'd sworn that if she did indeed ever find herself dancing on rooftops with chimney sweeps, she'd beat herself to death with her own umbrella. After tea, she read them a story. They liked her stories. The one in the book was pretty awful, but the Susan version was well received. She translated as she read. And then Jack chopped down the beanstalk, adding murder and ecological vandalism to the theft, enticement and trespass charges already mentioned, but he got away with it and lived happily ever after without so much as a guilty twinge about what he'd done, which proves that you can be excused just about anything if you're a hero, because no one asks inconvenient questions. And now, she closed the book with a snap, it's time for bed. The previous governess had taught them a prayer which included the hope that some god or other would take their soul if they died while they were asleep, and if Susan was any judge, had the underlying message that this would be a good thing. One day, Susan averred, she'd hunt that woman down. "Susan," said Twyla from somewhere under the blankets. "Yes?" "You know last week we wrote letters to the Hogfather?" "Yes." "Only, in the park, Rachel says he doesn't exist, and it's your father, really, and everyone else said she was right." There was a rustle from the other bed. Twyla's brother had turned over and was listening surreptitiously. Oh dear, thought Susan, she had hoped she could avoid this. It was going to be like that business with the soul cake duck all over again. "Does it matter if you get the presents anyway?" she said, making a direct appeal to greed.
"Yes."
Oh dear, oh dear. Susan sat down on the bed, wondering how the hell to get through this. She patted the one visible hand. "Look at it this way, then," she said, and took a deep mental breath. "Wherever people are obtuse and absurd, and wherever they have, by even the most generous standards, the attention span of a small chicken in a hurricane and the investigative ability of a one-legged cockroach, and wherever people are inanely credulous, pathetically attached to the certainties of the nursery, and in general have as much grasp of the realities of the physical universe as an oyster has of mountaineering, yes, Twyla, there is a Hogfather." There was silence from under the bedclothes, but she sensed that the tone of voice had worked. The words had meant nothing. That, as her grandfather might have said, was humanity all over. "Good night." "Good night," said Susan. It wasn't even a bar. It was just a room where people drank while they waited for other people with whom they had business. The business usually involved the transfer of ownership of something from one person to another. But then what business doesn't? Five businessmen sat round a table lit by a candle stuck in a saucer. There was an open bottle between them. They were taking some care to keep it away from the candle flame.
"It's gone six,"
said one, a huge man with dreadlocks and a beard you could keep goats in.
"The clock struck ages ago. He ain't coming. Let's go."
"Sit down, will you? Assassins are always late 'cause of style, right? This one's mental. Eccentric. What's the difference?
A bag of cash."
The three that hadn't spoken yet looked at one another.
Well, what's this? You never said he was an assassin,
said Chicken-Wire.
He never said the guy was an assassin, did he, Banjo?
There was a sound like distant thunder. It was Banjo Lilywhite clearing his throat.
Boo! That's right,
said a voice from the upper slopes.
You's never said.
The others waited until the rumble died away. Even Banjo's voice hulked.
He's...
The first speaker waved his hands vaguely, trying to get across the point that someone was a hamper of food, several folding chairs, a tablecloth, an assortment of cooking gear, and an entire colony of ants short of a picnic.
Mental. And he's got a funny eye.
It's just glass, all right,
said the one known as Cat's Eye, signalling a waiter for four beers and a glass of milk.
And he's paying $10,000 each. I don't care what kind of eye he's got.
I heard it was made of the same stuff they make them fortune-telling crystals out of. You can't tell me that's right. And he looks at you with it,
said the first speaker. He was known as Peachy, although no one had ever found out why. Peachy was not someone you generally asked questions of, except the sort that go like, if I give you all my money, could you possibly not break the other leg, thank you so much? Cat's Eye sighed. Certainly there was something odd about Mr. Tea Time. There was no doubt about that. But there was something weird about all assassins. And the man paid well. Lots of assassins used informers and locksmiths. It was against the rules, technically, but standards were going down everywhere, weren't they? Usually they paid you late and sparsely, as if they were doing the favour. But Tea Time was okay. True, after a few minutes of talking to him, your eyes began to water and you felt you needed to scrub your skin even on the inside. But no one was perfect, were they? Peachy leaned forward.
You know what, he said. I reckon he could be here already, in disguise, laughing at us. Well, if he's in here laughing at us,
he cracked his knuckles. Medium Dave Lilywhite, the last of the five, looked around. There were indeed a number of solitary figures in the low, dark room. Most of them wore cloaks with big hoods. They sat alone in corners, hidden by the hoods. None of them looked very friendly.
"Don't be daft, Peachy,"
Cat's Eye murmured.
"That's the sort of thing they do," Peachy insisted. "They're masters of disguise.
With that eye of his..."
"That guy sitting by the fire has got an eye patch,"
said Medium Dave. Medium Dave didn't speak much. He watched a lot. The others turned to stare.
"He'll wait till we're off our guard, then go, aha!" said Peachy. "They can't kill you unless it's for money,"
said Cat's Eye. But now there was a soupçon of doubt in his voice. They kept their eyes on the hooded man. He kept his eye on them. If asked to describe what they did for a living, the five men around the table would have said something like,
"This and that," or, "The best I can,"
although in Banjo's case he'd have probably said,
"Duh!"
They were, by the standards of an uncaring society, criminals, although they wouldn't have thought of themselves as such, and couldn't even spell words like nefarious. What they generally did was move things around. Sometimes the things were in fact people, who were far too unimportant to trouble the Assassin's Guild with, but who were nevertheless inconveniently positioned where they were and could much better be located on, for example, a seabed somewhere. Chickenwire had got his name from his own individual contribution to the science of this very specialised concrete overshoe form of waste disposal. An unfortunate drawback of the process was the tendency for bits of the client to eventually detach and float to the surface, causing much comment in the general population. Enough Chickenwire, he'd pointed out, would solve that, while also allowing the ingress of crabs and fish going about their vital recycling activities. None of the five belonged to any formal guild, and they generally found their clients among those people who, for their own dark reasons, didn't want to put the guilds to any trouble, sometimes because they were guild members themselves. They had plenty of work. There was always something that needed transferring from A to B, or, of course, to the bottom of the sea.
"Any minute now,"
said Peachy, as the waiter brought their beers. Banjo cleared his throat. This was a sign that another thought had arrived.
"What I don't understand,"
he said, is...
Yes, said his brother.
Ankh-Morpork's underworld, which was so big that the overworld floated around on top of it like a very small hen trying to mother a nest of ostrich chicks, already had Big Dave, Fat Dave, Mad Dave, Wee Davy, and Lanky Die. Everyone had to find their niche.
What I don't understand is, how long has this place had waiters?
Good evening, said Tea Time, putting down the tray. And they stared at him in silence. He gave them a friendly smile. Peach's huge hand slapped the table.
You crept up on us, you little...
he began. Men in their line of business develop a certain prescience. Medium Dave and Cat's Eye, who were sitting on either side of Peachy, leaned away nonchalantly. Hi, said Tea Time. There was a blur, and a knife shuddered in the table between Peachy's thumb and index finger. He looked down at it in horror.
My name's Teatime, said Tea Time. Which one are you?
I'm Peachy, said Peachy, still staring at the vibrating knife.
That's an interesting name, said Tea Time. Why are you called Peachy, Peachy?
Medium Dave coughed. Peachy looked up into Tea Time's face. The glass eye was a mere ball of faintly glowing grey. The other eye was a little dot in a sea of white. Peachy's only contact with intelligence had been to beat it up and rob it whenever possible, but a sudden sense of self-preservation glued him to his chair.
"'Cause I don't shave,' he said.
"'Peachy don't like blades, mister,' said Cat's Eye.
"'And do you have a lot of friends, Peachy?' said Tea Time.
"'Got a few, yeah?'
With a sudden whirl of movement that made the men start, Tea Time spun away, grabbed a chair, swung it up to the table and sat down on it. Three of them had already got their hands on their swords.
"'I don't have many,' he said apologetically. "'Don't seem to have the knack. On the other hand, I don't seem to have any enemies at all. Not one. Isn't that nice?'
Tea Time had been thinking in the cracking, buzzing firework display that was his head. What he had been thinking about was immortality. He might have been quite insane, but he was no fool. There were in the Assassin's Guild a number of paintings and busts of famous members who had in the past put... No, of course that wasn't right. There were paintings and busts of the famous clients of members with a noticeably modest brass plaque screwed somewhere nearby, bearing some unassuming little comment like, "Departed this Vale of Tears on Groon 3, Year of the Sideways Leech, with the assistance of the Honourable K.W. Dobson, Viper House." Many fine old educational establishments had dignified memorials in some hall, listing the old boys who had laid down their lives for monarch and country. The Guild's was very similar, except for the question of whose life had been laid. Every Guild member wanted to be up there somewhere, because getting up there represented immortality. And the bigger your client, the more incredibly discreet and restrained would be the little brass plaque, so that everyone couldn't help but notice your name. In fact, if you were very, very renowned, they wouldn't even have to write down your name at all. The men around the table watched him. It was always hard to know what Banjo was thinking, or even if he was thinking at all, but the other four were thinking along the lines of, "Bumptious little tit, like all assassins, thinks he knows it all. I could take him down one-handed, no trouble. But you hear stories, those eyes give me the creeps."
"So, what's the job?" said Chicken Wire.
"We don't do jobs," said Tea Time. "We perform services, and the service will earn each of you $10,000.
"That's a lot more than Thieves Guild's rate," said Medium Dave.
"I've never liked the Thieves Guild," said Tea Time, without turning his head.
"Why not? They ask too many questions."
"We don't ask questions," said Chicken Wire quickly.
"We shall suit one another perfectly," said Tea Time. "Do have another drink while we wait for the other members of our little troop." Chicken Wire saw Medium Dave's lips start to frame the opening letters WHO. These letters he deemed inauspicious at this time. He kicked Medium Dave's leg under the table. The door opened slightly. A figure came in, but only just. It inserted itself in the gap and sidled along the wall in a manner calculated not to attract attention. Calculated, that is, by someone not good at this sort of calculation. It looked at them over its turned-up collar.
"That's a wizard,"
said Peachy. The figure hurried over and dragged up a chair.
No, I'm not, it hissed. I'm incognito.
Right, Mr. Gnito, said Medium Dave. You're just someone in a pointy hat. This is my brother Banjo. That's Peachy. This is Chicken.
The wizard looked desperately at tea time.
I didn't want to come.
Mr. Sidney here is indeed a wizard, said Tea Time. A student, anyway, but down on his luck at the moment, hence his willingness to join us on this venture.
Exactly how far down on his luck?
Said Medium Dave. The wizard tried not to meet anyone's gaze.
I made a misjudgment to do with a wager, he said.
Lost a bet, you mean? Said Chickenwire.
I paid up on time, said Sidney.
Yes, but Chryso Praise the Troll has this odd little thing about money that turns into lead the next day, said Tea Time cheerfully, so our friend needs to earn a little cash in a hurry, and in a climate where arms and legs stay on.
No one said anything about there being magic in all this, said Peachy.
Our destination is probably you should think of it as something like a wizard's tower, gentlemen, said Tea Time.
It isn't an actual wizard's tower, is it? Said Medium Dave.
They got a very odd sense of humour when it comes to booby traps.
No.
Guards? I believe so, according to legend, but nothing very much.
Medium Dave narrowed his eyes.
There's valuable stuff in this tower?
Oh, yes.
Why ain't there many guards, then?
The person who owns the property probably does not realise the value of what they have.
Locks, said Medium Dave.
On our way, we shall be picking up a locksmith.
Who?
Mr. Brown. They nodded. Everyone, at least everyone in the business, and everyone in the business knew what the business was, and if you didn't know what the business was, you weren't a businessman, knew Mr. Brown. His presence anywhere around a job gave it a certain kind of respectability. He was a neat, elderly man who'd invented most of the tools in his big leather bag. No matter what cunning you'd use to get into a place, or overcome a small army, or find the secret treasure room, sooner or later you sent for Mr. Brown, who'd turn up with his leather bag, and his little springy things, and his little bottles of strange alchemy, and his neat little boots. And he'd do nothing for 10 minutes but look at the lock, and then he'd select a piece of bent metal from a ring of several hundred, almost identical pieces, and under an hour later he'd be walking away with a neat 10% of the takings. Of course, you didn't have to use Mr. Brown's services. You could always opt to spend the rest of your life looking at a locked door.
All right, where is this place? Said Peachy.
Tea Time turned and smiled at him.
If I'm paying you, why isn't it me who's asking the questions?
Peachy didn't even try to outstare the glass eye a second time.
Just want to be prepared, that's all, he mumbled.
Good reconnaissance is the essence of a successful operation, said Tea Time.
He turned and looked up at the bulk that was Banjo and added,
"What is this?"
"This is Banjo," said Medium Dave, rolling himself a cigarette.
"Does it do tricks?"
Time stood still for a moment. The other men looked at Medium Dave. He was known to Ankh Morpork's professional underclass as a thoughtful, patient man and considered something of an intellectual because some of his tattoos were spelled right. He was reliable in a tight spot, and above all, he was honest, because good criminals have to be honest. If he had a fault, it was a tendency to deal out terminal and definitive retribution to anyone who said anything about his brother. If he had a virtue, it was a tendency to pick his time. Medium Dave's fingers tucked the tobacco into the paper and raised it to his lips.
"Nope," he said.
Chickenwire tried to defrost the conversation.
"He's not what you'd call bright, but he's always useful. He can lift two men in each hand by their necks."
"Yeah,"
said Banjo.
"He looks like a volcano," said Tea Time.
"Really?"
said Medium Dave Lilywhite. Chickenwire reached out hastily and pushed him back down in his seat. Tea Time turned and smiled at him.
"I do so hope we're going to be friends, Mr. Medium Dave," he said. "It really hurts to think I might not be among friends."
He gave him another bright smile. Then he turned back to the rest of the table.
"Are we resolved, gentlemen?"
They nodded.
There was some reluctance given the consensus view that tea time belonged in a room with soft walls, but $10,000 was $10,000. Possibly even more. Good, said Tea Time. He looked Banjo up and down. Then I suppose we might as well make a start. And he hit Banjo very hard in the mouth.